This is The Loving Project, a podcast celebrating the 50th anniversary of Loving v. Virginia by featuring modern stories of interracial marriage. In this episode, we meet Arthi and Jonathan. Arthi was born in India, but migrated to the United States with her parents when she was just a few months old. She grew up in Delaware. Jonathan was born in New Hampshire.
They met in Chicago, where Jonathan was working as a journalist at the time, while Arthi was studying to get a PhD. They later moved to Washington, D.C., and then Philadelphia, where we interviewed them for this episode of The Loving Project.
I'm Jonathan, and I'm white.
I'm Arthi, and I'm Indian American brown skin. And we've been married since 2006.
And we have two kids, an 8-year-old girl and a 6-year-old boy. When I met your parents, the only way that race ever really raised its head in a really obvious way, and it continues to this day, is your mom believing I cannot eat spicy food.
Right.
Every single time. Yeah. She assumes that it must need to be milder.
She does that with all of my white friends.
Yeah. I don't think that's particularly
to me. I have friends, you know, that have been coming to my house eating food since we were kids that she's known for now 30 years, and she still says that.
So she continues to be impressed when I eat Indian food, and she continues to be impressed when I know a single word of Hindi or Tamil.
Mm-hmm.
As if, like, I had just climbed a mountain or something, you know, which is, that's, like, if that's racism, then, like, the world would be fine, right? So, like, it's not, like, it doesn't bother me really at all. But that's the only ever time I've even felt like your parents even thought very much, other than the wedding planning, which was a whole other story.
I was born in India, but came over very soon after, like, 3-4 months. Basically, my dad had come over to attend graduate school. And he came 6 months before I was born. And my mom didn't want to be pregnant and alone in a new country. So she stayed behind. And we lived with my grandparents and waited until kind of I was old enough to travel, basically. So I practically grew up in the U.S., but something about that being born in India, I think, has definitely shaped me as well. Just having an Indian passport and having to have been naturalized and making that decision, that choice to give up my Indian passport has all been pretty significant to me.
We used to tell people that we met through friends. We had this whole hilarious, complicated story. But the truth is, we met as an internet date. In the early days of internet dating, when it was really not cool to meet as an internet date.
Mm-hmm. And pretty much no expectations of love and all that jazz.
Yeah, neither of us was really in the place for a long-term relationship at that moment. We thought. And we kind of fell in love on the first date. It was a little nuts.
Yeah.
We met at a restaurant that I picked out near my apartment, and we just started talking, and we just hit it off. You were just unlike anyone I had really met before. You were so interesting, and you were doing such interesting things with your life. And we hit it off, and we stayed together for like 24 hours. Like, the date went to the next day, and, you know, we went out and got some breakfast, and then I hung out for the afternoon. And then that evening, I was like, do you like Indian food? And she was like, well, of course I like Indian food. And the Indian food in Chicago, this is, we were living in Chicago, was like on the north end of town. And she took me up there, and I was like, well, we'll go to this place. This is the place I always go. But that was a North Indian place, which is where all white people go to get Indian food. It's North Indian because it's got meat. Mm-hmm. And she was like, no, we're going to go over here where there's South Indian food, which is all vegetarian. And I was, of course, immediately skeptical because there's no meat. And that's what you eat when you have a meal. You eat meat. And we go in there, and of course, it's delicious. And it was my first South Indian meal, and I've had thousands since.
Yeah, it was a very amazing, unexpected night for both of us. I even had a friend. I had, like, a backup plan, like a party I had to go to afterwards, and a friend who showed up to sort of make sure I was okay. And I was just like, go, leave me alone, you know. I was really into this date. And, yeah, he just was so attentive. And that's hard to find. Yeah, it was quite remarkable how quickly we felt just at ease with each other.
And from there forward, we saw each other at a minimum every couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved in together within like 6 months.
before I had met John, like right before, really, I had been in a, broken up with somebody that I had been in with for a couple years, and he was white. And so, you know, I was home visiting my parents, and I remember very vividly, my mom was cooking. We were standing by the stove. She's like, "So, do you have anybody special in your life?" And I said, "No, you know, Paul and I broke up and I'm still pretty sad about that. But yeah, nobody really is cropping up." And then she said, "So, are you ready for your dad and I to start looking for you?" And I was completely dumbfounded because it wasn't anything we had ever talked about. And my parents were not an arranged marriage. They were a love marriage. But yeah, I was completely floored by the question. And I was just like, "No, that's okay. I think I want to look for myself, you know?" And she was like, "Well, have you even considered dating an Indian?" I said, "Yeah, I have actually dated a couple of Indian guys and just didn't work out." And then, I don't know, you know, moms and daughters, we kind of, it escalated. It escalated, and I was really irked by the whole conversation. And I was just like, it's hard to find Indian men who like understand how to be with somebody like me. You know, I have my own opinions and I'm got my work and all this stuff. And she was like, "Well, what about your father? He is wonderful. And how could you say that about him?" You know, and I was like, "That's not the point." And we were shouting at each other. Meanwhile, my dad is sitting in the dining room, which is just the next room over, like reading the newspaper, not looking at us. Finally, my mom says, "Well, I guess it's fine as long as you don't end up with some lesbian someday." And I was like, "Well, what if I do?" And then my dad turned around and said, "Yeah, what if she does?" And I was like, "Ooh." And then my mom's head whipped around at my dad, and it turned into this whole other fight between them, which was great for me because the heat was off. Yeah, so that whole conversation was sobering. For me, but I think also made it very clear that wasn't a priority for me.
Overall, I was pretty insensitive to the realities of racism at a personal level until I met Arthi. So I kind of went into it like, "Well, you know, it's America, it's 20 whatever, it's everything's gonna be fine. You know, what's the big deal? Racism's over, right?" You know, like, I mean, it's not that I didn't know. I was actually acutely aware at that point in my career about anti-Black racism because I was working covering courts and crime in Chicago. And you can't do that work without coming to a very deep and kind of visceral understanding about institutional racism towards the Black community. But that's different than knowing that when you tell your grandmother that you're dating an Indian woman, she would explain to you that the Indian people are really Caucasian and that they shouldn't refer to themselves as not Caucasian because they're from the Caucasus region. That's what Caucasian means. She had this extended riff that I still to this day don't understand about that.
I forgot that she did that.
Yeah, she was not really happy about it. I don't think she would have been happy at that stage with anybody who wasn't Jewish, but she was not excited about me dating Arthi, and it definitely was about her race, and I was completely floored by it. I did not see it coming at all. I loved my grandmother. I was very, very close with her. I thought of her as just an incredibly good person, and I did not expect that reaction. And to her deep credit, it took like a month for her to come around. I mean, she kind of met Arthi once, and, you know, Arthi's incredibly charming, and she was studying to get a PhD, and my grandmother put a tremendous value on education and on women in education. And so that I was with this woman who was pursuing her PhD was, she couldn't help herself. She fell in love with Arthi too. And pretty quickly, she started referring to Arthi as my granddaughter.
Yeah.
I don't even remember if she started doing that before we were married.
Yeah.
It feels like she did. I don't know.
Once we got engaged. She lived in a like an assisted living facility. She was in her 80s. We would go visit her and she would tell, "This is my granddaughter and this is my grandson." And
you could see these poor folks, you know, these waiters' eyes just cross, especially when she would introduce Arthi first. And they'd be like, "That's your grand daughter, and they'd just be like, there's some story here, we don't know. I'd sort of be mouthing at them, we're together. And they'd be like, oh, okay. So she and Arthi actually formed a very, very close relationship. It was really sweet. And grandma blessed us at the wedding. You know, it's a story where everything comes out great in the end, but it was there. It was there in some ways that I did not expect. And then for me, it was just this, as we dated and got closer and then got married, like just continually learning in new ways. The racism that Arthi faced was like for me sort of every day, like kind of, you know, not every day, thankfully, because I get to walk around being white most days, but.
Except Saturdays.
Oddly enough. You know, it was just this continual education for me that the world saw her differently, or at least a lot of white Americans saw her differently. And so that was, it was hard.
We went to a wedding, my friend's wedding in Kentucky. And I like stood up at the wedding and read something, you know. And then we were walking out after the service was over and, you know, the parents were like receiving people kind of thing. And so I got up to her dad and he took my hand and shook it and he said, "So, you Indian?" And it was just this really weird kind of.
I mean, he didn't say thank you. Or if he did, he said it very perfunctorily. He didn't comment on the fact that you read something in his daughter's wedding. He didn't ask how you guys know each other. He didn't care anything about you. He said some sort of perfunctory hello. And then he said, "So, you Indian?" And I remember you turned and said, "Yes, yes, I am." and then, because what else could you say? And then we just, and then I was like, "Congratulations on your daughter's wedding." And then we like walked away, and I was just steaming at this dude the whole rest of the darn wedding.
Yep.
To me, that's like where race has come up in our relationship. Like all of our friends, there was no real problems there. It's just about the world, and it's been hard. But I also, I feel for me at least, it's been enormously valuable. I mean, I think I've grown so much through understanding that experience differently in a way I never did. Our wedding wound up wonderful.
Yes.
Our wedding wound up wonderful. It was a fantastic wedding. We used to say that we like coasted on the energy of that wedding for years, sort of still do. It was a beautiful, it was a very intentional exercise in mingling the cultures of our families. We put a lot of thought into it, and it came out well. Mm-hmm. But her mom was absolutely terrified that the wedding would not be Indian enough.
Yeah.
I have a very clear memory of about a week before the wedding, Arthi getting a phone call from her mom. You know, she picks up the phone, and she's like, "Yeah, okay." She just, mm-hmm, and it goes on for like half an hour. She's clicking on something online. And I go over and said, "What's she saying to you?" And Arthi says, "She says there's not enough flowers." And I said, "But she doesn't know how many flowers there are." And it was just clear that however many flowers we had, it was not enough. And then two nights before the wedding, I don't even know how to tell the story in like a encapsulated way. It's an epic. There was a very lengthy conversation that I had to have with Arthi's mom in her hotel with her friends around her about the music that would play during the wedding. Mm-hmm. It was a pretty emotionally brutal conversation. At one point in time, she says, "If this music does not play, it will be like a funeral. It will be my funeral." The sort of funny part was, like we had always known that there would be a part of the ceremony, the Hindu part of the ceremony, where there would be music, and we wanted her to choose it. So I went into the room with a plan to give her whatever she wanted, but she was, I think, so anxious around not understanding what it is we wanted and what it was that a white person would want in this wedding.
Yeah.
That she was so afraid that she would not feel that her daughter was married. Mm-hmm. If this did not go a certain set of ways. So we had an hours long conversation that involved a pile of like 50 CDs and me.
And my sister was there and she was texting me. Meanwhile, I was secretly rehearsing a song that I was planning to sing for John. That's why I had banished him to my mom's place. And I had planned to sing a song with my dad and his dad playing instrumental behind us. So we needed a time to practice because there was only, you know, we were only together for a short amount of time. So, you know, people were really like, why would you do that? Like, send John over there. I'm like, there was a reason, you know?
Yeah. And that is partly
true. But he didn't know what it was.
I didn't know that. But you also could not have done this at this point
with
your mom.
No, that's true. That's true.
I mean, yeah. After the flowers, there's no way. We could have maybe tried to do it together, but it would have been bad.
That's true.
But, you know, like, we came out of it, and it brought us closer together, me and my mother-in-law. And, mm-hmm. you know, and we have a fantastic relationship.
My mom has two sisters still in India, and she had a brother. He passed away the same year we got married, actually. And yeah, I was very close with all of them because about every other year, I would go to India in the summers and spend a couple months there and live with my grandparents, both sets of grandparents, for, you know, 3-4 weeks at a time with my cousins, with my aunts and uncles. They kind of just passed me around. And, you know, that was my family, another family there for me. So I feel very close with all of those people, and I feel very attached to India in general. But it does get harder and harder to find the vacation time, the money, all of that to be able to go. I took the kids for the first time in November of 2014. Yeah, it was really fun to be there with them and for all my aunts and uncles, you know, and my cousins. We're generally a very affectionate family. And so they just, like, you know, lapped them up and loved playing with them and running around with them. And I think they got a lot out of that trip, just being there and kind of seeing what it was to be in India. And then, you know, riding around in auto rickshaws, and it was cool. And I mean, even now, Eli, it's interesting because that was 2 years ago. And he's starting to forget, I think. But he said to me the other day, like, we need to go back to India again. I really want to go soon. And I think he's getting scared about forgetting all the way. So I've been thinking about that a lot. But it kind of makes me happy that he feels that way and that he wants to go. Because you never know.
I mean, it's really true that they absolutely love, I'm not sure about Eli, but at least Asha absolutely loves both chicken tikka masala and lox on a bagel. And I just think she's going to be worldly. Him too. They're both going to be just wonderfully worldly children. Obviously, they're learning so much about Indian culture. They're learning so much about, I guess, my family's culture, my family's history. But I feel like, and maybe this is just proud father and maybe this isn't reality, but I feel like just the fact that they understand that there can be more than one way for these things to be has them open to so much more about the world and the way other people may celebrate things or think about life or think about family way more than I ever had as a kid. In the winter, we do Diwali, mm-hmm. and then we do Hanukkah, mm-hmm. and then we do Christmas.
Yeah, there's a lot.
There's a lot. And all of those are
really fun.
All those are festivals that are about lighting things in, mm-hmm. in the dark. And it just means that there's three lighting things in the winter for us instead of just one lighting thing. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And they ask a lot of questions.
There's so many things
to talk about. And they've really come to accept a biracial, I mean, for now. I mean, who knows? They're going to have, at some point, Asha's going to do some very, very soulful NPR piece about her racial identity. It's going to have stories of her grandmother and cooking and the time she went to India. It's going to be beautiful. But for now, where they are now, they're very accepting of a biracial identity. They think of themselves as they are both white and Indian. I mean, they really accept that those things can be both there and they can hold on to both at the same time.
It's been fascinating to sort of observe their own identity development. Like, our son, when he was like 4 or something like that, believed that Asha was Indian and he was Jewish. That couldn't both be both things. So it must be, and he cut it along gender lines, I guess. So there was that phase for a little while.
I remember when they first started to talk, both of them went mm-hmm. through a phase of trying to understand what color was they were. There was mm-hmm. conversations around it. And at one point in time, Asha, who was an early talker, said that mommy was dark brown.
Oh yeah.
I'm light brown and daddy is dark white.
Uh-huh.
Which to this day I'm really curious.
Oh, man. I'm so glad you remember that.
Yeah. I always I just think that should be like a, I don't know, it's like a racist superhero or something. I don't really know.
Dark White.
Avenging something. The thing that's hard for me is every now and then it makes me feel a little cut off from them. Like, they know that they're brown-skinned, but I'm not, right? And, like, it's just very, very clear that at some point they're going to have some sort of experience that I can do my best to understand, I can do my best to help with, but will never be an experience that I have or that I have to go through or that I will intrinsically understand. You know, my son's going to get his heart broken by a girl someday, and I'm going to be able to be there for him, having had my heart broken by many girls over the years. And that's what you do when you're a dad. You try to connect to your own experience and then try to be there for your kid. And it's hard for me to know that that's not going to be something I can do for them in that moment. But it's also beautiful to me to see the way that they, for them, they're just, these barriers are just not the same. I mean, all of their friends in school are kids of color. It's just not a thing. And I grew up in New Hampshire. It was something crazy, like 95% white or something, right? There were a couple of kids I knew in high school that I was on speaking terms with who were kids of color. But certainly I had no close friends of color as a kid. Not because I was a terrible person or my parents are terrible people, because New Hampshire is 95% white and it just didn't happen. And just to see that that's not their world is, it's something we, you know, we talk about a lot. My biggest thing is just worrying about Eli as he gets bigger. I mean, Eli is such a beautiful boy. He's such a little ray of light. He is so full of love for people. It's really uncanny. He cares so deeply about people being happy. Strangers, family members, all he ever wants for them is to experience love and joy. He talks all the time about how he just wishes that Grammy and Grandpa could be here all the time so that all the family can always be all together all the time, because he just wants that. And yet he's going to grow bigger, I think. And, you know, he's rambunctious because he's full of joy. He's going to be horsing around on the street someday, and some cop is going to see him and think there's a Latino boy who's causing trouble. And I worry about him getting shot. I mean, I worry about him getting shot by some freaked out cop who sees a brown kid doing something that that cop thinks a kid shouldn't be doing. He's not going to know that Eli is half white and half Indian and has two respectable parents. Not that that should matter if he does or doesn't. He's just going to see a brown kid and freak out. I don't know that that's going to happen, but Jesus, it happens all the time. So why wouldn't it? And who knows? We've got a few years till he's a teenager. Maybe we can solve racism before then and everything will be fine.
We're working on it.
Yeah, working on it. He's still so small that he's not a no one would suspect any problem for him yet. There's no reason to scare him with any of that yet.
But he is aware right now of Donald Trump and...
Yeah. He got really scared
after
Donald Trump won.
He was scared that we would have to leave, he and my daughter. And, you know, we both work in social justice. We talk a lot. We're both loud people. And so we don't really censor ourselves that much in front of the children. So I'm sure that they picked that up from us to some extent. And also their school, which is majority kids of color. So... You know, I think there's a general sense of fear and misgiving about the change in the climate right now. So I do think there's some awareness there about risk, but not in a specific kind of way.
Yeah. I mean, and then the day after the election, there was a swastika painted across the street in that park right over there.
Yeah.
And I'm half Jewish and was raised mostly Jewish, and I work now for a Jewish social justice organization. So I don't like swastikas. I'm a little against them. I used to be mostly worried about the police when it came to the safety of my children. Now I start to worry about everybody.
Mm-hmm. But the nice thing about this neighborhood is... there's actually a lot of mixed race couples in this area.
Yeah. So there was a swastika painted the day after the election in the park across the street. And a week after that, there were 200 people in that park painting and chalking the park with messages of love and tolerance and acceptance. So that's what this neighborhood really is. And I try to remember that. And that's true. That's what this neighborhood really is. It's still scary.
Yeah. Definitely.
We'd like to thank Jonathan and Arthi for sharing their story with us.
You can find out more about the Loving Project at our website, lovingproject.com, where you'll also find more episodes, links to follow us on social media, and pictures of some of the families featured on the podcast.
The Loving Project is available in iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and just about anywhere else you find podcasts. I'm Farrah Parks.
And I'm Brad Linder. Thanks for listening to The Loving Project.
In the next episode of The Loving Project, we'll hear from Loria and Manuel. Loria is black and Manuel is white. They met and fell in love in Spain, where Manuel was born. But when they moved to the United States together, he was surprised by the anti-black racism Lori dealt with.
For example, there was the time they arranged by phone to move into an apartment in Brooklyn. But then they went to pick up the keys in person.
And the man who was behind the desk, I go, what is your name? Oh yeah, okay. He left and then he came back and he was like, you know, that apartment, there's a problem, it's been taken. And you know, he made up some BS excuse. But the point is that when he saw her, you know, that apartment was no longer available.
Yeah, I barely remember that. And it's,
I don't remember.
He remembers it so clearly. What's interesting is that as a black woman, I think it didn't register that much as his thing, but he was like, can you believe?
Lori and Manuel's story, coming up next time on the Loving Project podcast.